bridge to information geometry.
Thanks, Chris. Quantum theory is an extraordinarily successful physical theory, which gives us reason enough to think that it captures fundamental aspects of the workings of the physical world. It would be of inestimable value to be able to articulate these features very clearly. This could have ramifications for many different projects or programs in physics. But traditionally, it's been very difficult to actually articulate these features, and most attempts, most progress in quantum foundations has tended to take the quantum formalism as a given and attempt to, in some way or another, extract features that it seems to have. In the period immediately after the quantum formalism was created, concepts like entanglement and complementarity were articulated, obviously, and the statistical interpretation of the wave function was given, and it was discovered when it was realized that measurements could have finite numbers of possible outcomes. And then in the period since then, concepts like contextuality and non-locality were constructed. In that case, the kind of thinking that's required is much more subtle. One is actually comparing predictions of quantum theory with the predictions of a model, which is characterized by some set of physical assumptions. And then one is showing that those predictions, the predictions of quantum theory and the predictions of the model in the context of some physical situation, don't agree. And then you infer that some of the assumptions underlying the model must be incorrect. So it's a much more elaborate line of thinking that's necessary to actually arrive at these concepts. And then, relatively recently, through thinking about quantum theory from an information theoretic point of view, concepts like non-locality and a whole slew of other features have been articulated. And then taking the quantum formalism as a mathematical structure and then comparing it with the mathematical structures which underlie the other physical theories, we can pick out features that it has which are non-trivial. For example, the fact that states evolve linearly, the fact that it has a complex form, and that seems to be a fundamental aspect of it. And the fact, for example, it has this global gauge invariance property, meaning the overall space of a pure state is not predictably relevant or important. And then there are higher level features which have been individuated, things like the fact that transition probabilities between two states are symmetric in two states, and the fact that between any two pure states you can find a reversible continuous transformation. So these are higher level ideas which you might think that we have more of an intuition about, and we may think that this provides a certain understanding of some part of the quantum formalism. A picture like this raises a number of questions. The most obvious one is, are we missing something? Are there concepts which I haven't written down here, which haven't yet been conceived, which are in some sense really essential to a comprehensive understanding of quantum theory? That's not a completely unreasonable thing to imagine. Concepts like no cloning seem pretty fundamental, but they were only conceived relatively recently. And then we can ask, we have many concepts here. Are some of them in some sense more fundamental than the others? So you might imagine that there'd be some which would perhaps of primary importance and others which are secondary or derived. And of course, then you can also ask, sort of thirdly, whether these concepts really should be taken at face value. For example, maybe underlying probabilistic measurements, there's a deterministic underpinning, and we don't know that. So all of these questions cast doubt on most of these concepts in one way or another. What we might do to try to answer these questions is to say that if we have a way of thinking about reality, let's suppose that we actually imagine that these concepts here are in some sense fundamental, then we ought to be able to derive quantum theory from them. So this is the program of reconstruction. The idea is to say that let's suppose that we have an inkling that the reality described by quantum theory behaves us in a certain way, that we all ought to be able to mathematize our understanding in some natural way, and thereby derive the quantum formalism. And if we can do that, it would give a great deal of confidence that we really do have our hands on a perspective that really does capture the essence of quantum theory. Such a derivation wouldn't exclude the possibility of other derivations starting out from different sets of initial concepts. And you know, it might not be possible to do that mathematization without introducing formal assumptions that we can't physically justify at the outset. And if that happens, then that it does point out some deficiency in our understanding and focuses our attention on that lack of understanding, and hopefully provides some points of departure for a growth of a better understanding.
Was there meant to be a significant difference between the items on the outer circle and the items in the inner circle, such that you wouldn't want to consider derivation of quantum formalism from something like complementarity?
I mean, there is a difference here. I mean, there is a rough sense in which these are closer to the quantum formalism. You can read these off in a sense. They're very closely tied to the quantum formalism, whereas certainly these two concepts seem to, because of the thing I mentioned, the fact that they involve, I mean, non-locality involves a theorem which involves lots of assumptions, not just one assumption. So I would tend to prefer assumptions which are closer rather than further away, but it's very much a question of taste.
Okay, maybe a related question then. Should we or shouldn't we think of the stuff on the inner circle as being derivable from the stuff on the outer circle?
Okay. Well, the thing is, in reconstruction of quantum theory, which is something that has generated a lot of interest recently, I mean, there are different approaches. Some people take things like non-locality and no signaling as really quite basic ideas, and then they hope that they can use that to constrain the formalism in a big way. Other people take things like complementarity. Some people take these. So people make all kinds of choices depending on what seems to fit their particular way of thinking. So there's no hard and fast rule here.
Did you say what you meant by measurement similar to?
I'm going to explain. I'll explain that later.
So it just occurred to me that it might be worth just making that distinction between, I guess there are many ways you could read something on the inner circle. So I think I understand what you're saying, that the superposition principle, for example, only makes sense if you have a quantum state. So you can talk, it seems to postulate the quantum formalism to even make sense of it. And other items might also be thought in that way. So complementarity, you might say, is the existence of bases that have equal overlaps. But you could also try to phrase various ones of these in a way that doesn't require the quantum formalism. So you could say complementarity is true of any theory wherein you could have one measurement such that any outcome here makes the outcome of another measurement really unpredictable. Then you'd have a way of phrasing complementarity that didn't rely on the quantum formalism at all.
Right.
So am I right to think that the outer circle are things that can be phrased without relying on quantum formalism, and stuff in the inner circle is something that really requires the quantum formalism?
I think you're reading more into this than I intended. I mean, so I was more talking, I mean, yeah, so, yeah. I mean, I think you can express complementarity, as you said, without the quantum formalism, not likewise non-locality. I mean, most of these, in some way or another, you can find a way of expressing it without explicitly talking about the quantum formalism. So that, I'm not trying to imply that. So the reconstruction that I'll describe in the rest of this talk is based on a few of these ideas. And so it's a derivation of the finite dimensional quantum formalism. And the concept of information enters in two senses. First of all, through this thing called the information metric, which I'll explain in a moment. And then through a novel information theoretic principle or postulate, which says that transformations of the state space of the system preserve the metric of the state space. And that metric is inherited from this guy here. So first of all, some preliminaries. I'm just going to assume that when a measurement is performed, it yields one of n possible outcomes with probabilities little p1 through little pn, which are determined by the state of the system. So I'm restricting here to finite numbers of possible outcomes. And I'm also going to assume that the measurements are reproducible, so that when they're repeated immediately afterwards, they yield the same outcome with certainty. And now the information metric.
That's quite a restrictive notion of measurement.
Yeah.
For instance, it wouldn't cover P of the M.
That's right. That's a deliberate restriction. So the information metric is a metric over the space of probability distributions. And what it does is basically provide a measure of how, one way of thinking about it anyway, it's a measure of how difficult it is to distinguish two nearby probability distributions from one another, just if you're given only a finite number of samples from each one. Okay, so normally we think of probability distributions as just points in probability space. But if you actually think about the process of how you actually learn about them, you learn about them by sampling from them. And if you've got two nearby distributions and you only allow, say, 10 samples from each, then you're really not, then each point actually expands to a little ball, a ball, basically a Gaussian distribution. And if those distributions are too close to one another, you can't reliably distinguish those two probability distributions. So it's through this tension between the theoretical description, the probabilities, and the frequencies, which represent our sampling information, the tension, out of the tension between those two things, this information metric arises. Mathematically, a very nice way of seeing how metric arises is to imagine a simple game. So imagine that Alice has two coins, A and B, characterized by these probability distributions P and P dash. And suppose that she takes one of the coins and tosses it n times and sends the data string of heads and tails to Bob. And you ask the question, well, how much information does Bob get about which coin Alice tossed? On the assumption that he knows all of this, so he knows which two coins Alice holds. He just doesn't know which one she chose, which one she decided to toss. And in the special case, if you take a special case where these two probability distributions are very close to one another, so they're very close on the probability simplex, then you find that the information Bob gains is just some function of n, which is the number of tosses, times ds squared. And ds squared is the information metric. And this function f is determined as soon as you specify your entropy function. It could be the Shannon entropy or the Rayleigh entropy, it doesn't matter. Once you've chosen that, f is determined. So the important thing is that the information gained by Bob, insofar as it depends on these two distributions, only depends on the distance between them. That's all that matters. And this generalizes to arbitrary dimensions.
Does it generalize to the case where you have dice A and dice B, and you don't know how many sides they have different numbers of sides?
If you...
Known numbers of sides, but different.
Known are different.
Because you could be comparing two different measurements, which have a different number of outcomes.
Right. It's not a question I've considered.
You could always say that they have the same number of outcomes, which is a large number, and one mass probability is zero.
Yeah. Sure, but then that might become a desirable problem. Metric that, regardless of the dimension you're imagining, the metric is well
paid. You know, that sort of thing, because suppose you have a 5-sided die and a 7-sided die, and you've got outcome 7. Then you know which one you've got.
But for large numbers, then that wouldn't go down the median.
You've never seen that. Usually these information measures are more expensive. I shouldn't say usually, I've never.
No, it's like you're constantly finding like cool factor, like that. you get singularity, of course.
You've seen it?
Yeah. I suppose this is also when n is large.
Right.
Okay. So in that case, you get you can distinguish asymptotically because sooner or later, one of the outcomes which the other doesn't. So it becomes less interesting. Yeah, and it's large.
Okay, so one of the things that would be very useful in a moment is to make a change of variables. So right now we're working in the probability simplex, and the metric, the information metric, looks like this. And if we make a change of variables, so we go to the square roots of probability space, so square root of p1, p2, and p3, then the information metric just takes on this Euclidean form, where I define q sub I equals the square root of p sub I. I mean, one interesting thing to point out is that if you, on this simplex, if you plot points which represent probability distributions that are just distinguishable from each other in n samples, then they're not uniformly distributed. But if you, when you transform like this into this space, the points are all equally distributed. So that's another way of thinking about what you're doing when you're doing this variable transformation.
I don't know if this is relevant, but say if it's not relevant, but this is a Riemannian metric, a local metric. So if you wanted the distance between two finitely separated points, using this, you would find the geodesic distance. But if you use the information measure, you find something different. You find this, whatever it's called, callback-Leibler measures, which is not the same as the geodesic distance.
So okay.
Should we worry about that?
Okay, yeah. So for the purpose of this reconstruction, you don't need to worry about it because I only ever need to use this, the metric. So I never need to worry about distances between finitely separated probability distributions. What you say is absolutely right, that basically if you want to specify distances between far apart distributions, you need some kind of connection. And if you assume the Lemaitre connection, then you would get the cost of the minus, you get the arc length, the length of the arc connecting them. And then Sumichi Amari has defined a different class of connections other than the Lemaitre connection. And basically they have the property that you get, basically the line joining the two probability distributions is no longer a geodesic necessarily. And one of those gives the callback Leibler distance. So in other words, into this geometry, you can kind of bring in things like the callback Leibler distance, but you need to consider a broader family of connections than we're used to from the default connection. It turns out not to be important here. Okay, so the remaining four ideas, I'm going to implement them in four steps. And in each step, I'll express them in the context of this probability theory with this information metric, and then see where it leads us. So the first idea is complementarity, and so here, because I'm trying to express this without the quantum formalism, so we need a way of expressing this complementarity in a very general way. So the idea is basically the following: that in classical physics, we can, in principle, let's say classical mechanics, we can, in principle, perform a measurement on a system which tells us about all of the degrees of freedom at once. And by complementarity, we mean the general idea that when I perform a measurement, for some reason, I'm not able to see all of the degrees of freedom of the system at once. I'm only able to access roughly half of them. So this is the very simple idea. And the question is how to express that within this probabilistic framework. So in classical probability theory, all we have to deal with are events and probabilities of those events. So one thing we can do is the following. So far we said that when measurement A is performed, there are n possible outcomes. One simple idea is to introduce a layer of events, of 2n events which are probabilistically realized when measurement A is performed, but which we don't directly have access to. And that when event one or two occurs, then what we see is outcome one. So you have a kind of cross-graining at this level. So little p1 equals capital 1 plus capital P2, and so on down the line. And I'll talk later on about this hypothesis of these events, which are not directly observed, what that might mean and why that might be the case. So then, so far, what we have as the state of the system is this probability distribution here. And in preparation for imposing the information metric, I will switch to the square roots space. So now I'll represent the state in this way. And then this condition here relating the outcome probabilities with the capital P's transforms to this condition here, which is just a simple change of variables. And then what I'll do is to impose the information metric over this probability distribution, over the space of probability distributions. And what that transforms to is the Euclidean metric here over this space here. So this lies on the positive orthont here, the two-dimensional, in a two-dimensional Euclidean space. So it lies on the positive orthont of this hypersphere. Okay, so that's step one. The next thing is to ask, what about transformations? How do we represent transformations of a physical system? What kind of transformations of state space are allowed? What I'm going to do now is to impose a condition on this mapping. I'm going to require it's one-to-one, but beyond that, I'm going to require that if I have two nearby states, Q and Q dash, then the distance between them is preserved by the transformation. So what's the intuition behind that? Well, as I said, when I talked about complementarity, that classically we assume that there's in principle one measurement that just tells us everything about the system all in one go. But as soon as we impose this idea of complementarity, it means that there are inequivalent perspectives that you can take on a system. You could do different measurements, each of which is complete in itself as it's going to be, but they're inequivalent. So you could have different measurements, like different Stern-Gerlach measurements on a spin. Now, if they're going to be these different perspectives, you might think that there might be invariant quantities which, when they're evaluated with respect to these different perspectives, gives the same value. So the underlying idea I had in mind is stamped in special relativity, where if you go to different inertial frames, you'll have different perspectives on the physical situation, but they're invariants, like the space-time distance, which are the same in all different frames. So as soon as you introduce this idea of complementarity, the question is, are there any invariants? So what I'm postulating here is that there is an invariant, and that's the distance between two nearby Q vectors, two nearby distributions. This is all very well, but problem immediately arises that on the simplex, which is what we've got here, or basically on the orthont, there aren't any continuous one-to-one transformations that preserve the metric. If I want to preserve the metric, I need a rigid transformation, and there isn't one which will keep me within the orthont. So I seem to be stuck at this point. The only thing that you can do is permute the q's, the axes. So if this is all that we have, then we're very limited in terms of what we can do. We can't represent things like temporal evolution, for example.
These cues, are they meant to belong to a particular measurement, or are they meant to be sort of more universal things that somehow will, by mixing them up appropriately, will give the outcome for all measurements? So they're like the usual quantum state.
Okay. Yeah, so everything right now is being done with respect to one measurement, so one measurement A. And then later on, basically, we'll be able to shift perspectives. So right now, so what will turn out is that these 2n q variables will end up being the real and imaginary parts of a pure state.
Right. So you're assuming that if you change the, if you do this transformation, let's say this perspective shifting transformation,
right,
that with respect to the same measurement, the distance is preserved. Okay. And you might worry that, well, it's a different measurement seen from another perspective, so why should the distance be invariant?
Okay, yeah. That will become clearer later on, because what I'll show you is that...
It's like the time separation in a particular frame is not right. Preserved.
Oh, yeah, so certain invariant. That doesn't mean it's going to be invariant. So what happens later on is I define any other measurement in terms of the measurement A. So it actually deals with that problem. I'll maybe come back to that point later on.
So just, are you assuming it's something, maybe you've already said, are you assuming that these probabilities for any given measurement can take any real value? Because if there is actually only a limited number of probabilities, a finite number, say, for each outcome, maybe you could find a transformation which preserves this.
Right.
If you're only preserving distances between a finite number of points, etc.
Right. Yeah, so the assumption I'm making is, so because I haven't got any reason to kind of rule out any part of this author, I'm assuming that you could actually be anywhere. Yeah. So to get past this problem, there's one purely formal way out, and that is you can simply extend the state space to the whole of the hydrosphere. And if you do that and then impose this condition that the distances are preserved, then you find something non-trivial, that the mapping must be orthogonal. Basically, you've got orthogonal transformation of the unit hydrosphere. So this is the point of the derivation where I'm making a purely formal assumption that I don't have any good physical understanding of or reason to postulate. But it allows us to make progress. Without making an assumption like this, you can see that we would end up with an impasse, essentially. The third step is the idea of global gauge invariance. Ignore this for the second. So what I mean by global gauge invariance at the very basic level is that we have a state of the system specified by some real degrees of freedom, but not all of those degrees of freedom are actually relevant for making predictions. So with the idea of global gauge transformation is that I can find some subset of the degrees of freedom, and if I displace them all by the same amount, then it doesn't change any of the predictions that I would make. So how do I actually impose that condition on this vector Q? Well, we said that if we make measurement A, then the outcome probabilities are P1 through Pn, which are given by these expressions here. And certainly I can't play around with those outcome probabilities, because that would immediately be experimentally detectable. So let me rewrite Q in terms of these outcome probabilities, these P1 through Pn, and some other set of n variables, which I'll just call theta1 through theta n. Okay. And now I can impose the global gauge invariance condition in one particular form as follows. I say that each of these theta1 through theta n are some universal function theta of chi I, where the chi I are some set of n real degrees of freedom. So in other words, we can write the state Q like that, and then assume that this is a global gauge transformation. In other words, in this expression here, if I add a constant, the constant chi naught, to each of these chi's, then it won't change any predictions that I make on the basis of the state. So that's the idea. So now I need to implement this. And there are two ideas which I draw from it. First of all, the idea of measure invariance. So I said that we have this metric over the state space, and that induces a natural measure over the state space. So the idea of measure invariance is to say that that measure must also be invariant under the global gauge transformation, under this displacement. So let me just show you what that means, first of all. So we have this metric over state space. We've made this change of variables, and then we can rewrite the metric in this form, where now it depends on this function theta, which is not yet determined. And then if we take the square root of the determinant of that metric, we end up with a measure over the state space. Here I've expressed it over the little p's and the chi's. And you can see it's a function of, it depends on this unknown function theta. The details don't really matter. I just want to show you that there's a clear path from the metric to the measure. So the actual condition that I'm imposing here is this one, which is, as I said, that if I displace these variables all by the same amount, it doesn't change the value of the measure. And what that does is to actually tell you that this function theta is actually linear in time. And this means that we can now write Q explicitly in this form here, where I've just defined for convenience phi I equals A chi I plus B. So this is the form of Q now. One thing I should say is that what's the intuition behind requiring this measure have this property here? Well, one of the big motivations comes from Bayesian probability theory. So in Bayesian probability theory, if you want to make an inference about this system, what you would commonly do is actually to take the natural measure over state space as your prior in your inferential procedure. And standard idea in Bayesian probability theory is that your prior should encode any knowledge you have about the system prior to obtaining data explicitly. And since we know the global gauge transformation, the global gauge invariance property holds, this measure better actually have that property. So that's one way of thinking about why one should request this. Okay, the second idea, the second sort of application of global gauge invariance is the following. We just imagine a state Q, which we transform using an orthogonal transformation to state Q dash. And from the state Q dash, we can extract these outcome probabilities. So imagine doing measurement A on the state Q dash. What we're going to observe, what we're going to gain information about are these probabilities, P1 dash through Pn dash. And so what we're going to require is that if I make this transformation in these variables here, then it's not going to affect these outcome probabilities.
Why is there only one phi naught or chi naught? Why isn't it dependent on I? So it would seem that you can add a different constant to each pair whilst leaving the probabilities unchanged.
Okay, yeah. So what I'm doing is to take this the case where I'm just going to require that there's a global change. So you add the same constant to all. What you're talking about is a local change.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very much more restrictive, you know, assumption and or the condition. I mean, it doesn't hold in, certainly in quantum theory, if you were to make that kind of transformation on the phases, then with respect to the measurement in which you're writing the state, in the basis in which you're writing the state, the outcome probabilities wouldn't be effective. But the outcome probabilities of almost every other measurement would be effective. You know what I mean?
In that case, you're maybe lacking a motivation for why assume global gauge invariance as opposed to local gauge invariance.
Right.
The only motivation you've shown so far is that you need this
right
to preserve the predictions.
Right. Yes, I mean, I haven't given the intuition here. I should have mentioned that. I mean, one, the major motivation, well, one argument that I've used So one way of thinking about it is that this is an ingredient. This is an ingredient that we can take as a starting point, simply because it is a formal feature of quantum formalism that we can express in this very general way. And it does, gauge invariance in general seems to be a very fertile concept in physics. It seems that it does seem to be. So it seems like, okay, as a formal ingredient, we could perhaps take it as a given. That would be one way of thinking. Another way of thinking is that is by a classical quantum correspondence argument, and that was my original way of thinking about this. So the idea is that if we have a particle moving in space, then I can form a quantum model of that situation and also a classical model. And the classical model would be the Hamilton-Jacobi, the corresponding classical model would be the Hamilton-Jacobi model of the system. And the argument goes, if you want a one-to-one correspondence between a quantum state and the Hamilton-Jacobi state, then you end up, basically, because the Hamilton-Jacobi state also has this global gauge invariance, because the action in the Hamilton-Jacobi, you can add a constant to that, and it doesn't change physical predictions, then you need the same idea. You need the same property in the quantum state. But as you can see, it's kind of a long-winded argument, which is why I didn't mention it. But that's one argument from classical quantum correspondence.
I didn't follow the details of that argument, but maybe
we have that. In essence, the idea is that Hamilton-Jacobi would be the thing that corresponds to a quantum model of a particle. The Hamilton-Jacobi model has a global gauge invariance. Therefore, if you want a tight connection between the quantum and classical models, then the quantum model must also have the global gauge invariance property. In essence, that's the argument. So this here is a very, very strong condition on what the transformation M can be. We've said it's orthogonal, but as a result of imposing this condition, we find out that M must look like this. Here I'm showing a four-dimensional example. So basically, it must take the form of a scale rotation. So each of these entries is a scale rotation. And it's either of this type 1, or this type, which is very similar, except that you also have this reflection matrix here. Now, at this point, we actually have the core of the quantum formalism, but it's actually expressed in real form. So let me show you what the correspondence is. So far we've got that the state is given by this object here, and the transformations are given by type 1 or type 2 orthogonal transformations. So let's just write this in complex form like this. That's fairly straightforward. And then ask, what do these correspond to? But you find that the type 1 transformations correspond to unitary transformations, and the type 2 correspond to anti-unitary transformations. And these are one-to-one correspondences. So without any loss of generality, we can just work with the complex form here. Now, everything that we've done so far is with respect to measurement A. So we've got no Born rule at the minute. So very quickly, I'll just show you how that comes about. So first of all, this expression goes over to this expression here, but in the complex form. And what that means is that we know how to predict the outcome probabilities of measurement A given any input state. In particular, you've got this special set of states which, when fed into this measurement, yield outcome I with certainty. And because of this repetition assumption I made at the beginning, the output state must also be the same. It must be VI up to an overall phase. So now we want to be able to figure out what happens to measurement A dash. So this is some other measurement. So I feed in a state V into this measurement and I ask, what are the outcome probabilities and what are the outcome states? Okay. So measurement simulability is the idea that I can replace that measurement A with this arrangement here. In other words, I can simulate measurement A, A dash, sorry, in terms of measurement A, provided I blank measurement A with interactions with the system here and here. The intuition for that, well, one intuition for that is that experimentally we know this to be possible. So in the case of a Stern-Gerlach measurement, if I have a Stern-Gerlach apparatus in the z-direction, and I say I want to do a measurement along this direction, well, I can either rotate my apparatus, or I can leave my apparatus fixed and just put uniform magnetic fields either side, which basically do a rotation like that, and then do a rotation like that. So this is just, and this is something that one sees trivially from the quantum formalism itself. So what I'm doing here is taking this as an actual postulate. So
a measurement always means a complete measurement of something.
Yeah, so what I'm asserting is that any measurement that can be described in this formalism can be represented like this.
And then what if you do a partial measurement? It doesn't ask, you know, corresponds to the individual results are subspaces of higher dimension than one.
Right, I know what you mean. So you're a measurement that doesn't discriminate, say, between two.
Yeah, so
I mean, I haven't stated all the assumptions very carefully here, but so the idea is that with measurement A, it basically does discriminate as finely as possible. So
that's what I meant. It's every measure has to be.
Yeah, and then
the finest possible measure.
Yes. I mean, there are caveats, small caveats. So okay, how do we use this arrangement? Well, if we feed in this state here.
Isn't this a very strong assumption? That basically all measurements are similar to each other in the automorphism group of the.
Yeah, so basically
the state space.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, for finite dimensional quantum systems, I don't mean that's.
I'm not saying it's wrong. I'm just saying it seems like a very restrictive. What's the motivation for it, I suppose, would be the question.
Well, okay, so that's quite long-winded, but there is a very good motivation for that. I can't, it's too much to go into at this moment. But it's based on, there is a very clear physical motivation for actually singling out maximally discriminative measurements, which are basically projective measurements.
No, I didn't mean that. What's the motivation for this measurement simulability?
Oh, this one.
Assumption?
Okay, so one would be a direct generalization from experimental observations. So we know that we can, indeed, if you want to implement Stern-Gerlach measurements on a spin, you can just carry out this process where you can simulate any Stern-Gerlach measurement in terms of any other one. So that would be one kind of argument for it. Another would be sort of a theoretical. But it's there.
That's not really true. I mean, if it's spin zero, spin half, yes. But
yeah, I know for spin half, that's what I mean.
But if it's spin one or spin two, then I don't think it's true anymore.
Yeah.
It's not true experimentally. I mean.
Right.
There's no simple experimental.
What I'm saying is that there's certainly a case where it's true. So that would be one reason why you might at least think of this as an idea.
It's still true for higher dimensional spaces. It's just that the unitaries don't correspond to rotations.
That's what I meant. Yeah. So there's no simple, at least I can't think of any simple experimental implementation.
It may not be simple, but it's possible.
Sure, it's possible in principle, but I mean, if we want to stick to what people actually do in the lab, it's not, maybe it's true, but it's not so clear to me that it's really possible.
Well, there are certain examples like if I have multiple paths, I can say the d-dimensional Hilbert space corresponds to one photon, one d path, and there's a simple way of implementing any unitary on that.
But I think you only know this because you know the quantum formalism and you go to some pains to work out how to do these unitaries. It's not sort of a fact that hits you in the face. Like the one with the spin and a half Stern Gerlach, where all you have to do is rotate.
I mean, with all of these assumptions, I mean, the thing is, we know the answer, so we know what we're aiming for. So there's always this feeling of, well, how much have we gained by this process? So the idea is, though, as I said right at the very beginning, is that we know that quantum theory has lots and lots of features, or we think we do. But if we can take a few of those, isolate them, and build up the whole of the formalism from them, then that's some kind of progress. So if we feed this particular state through, then you can see that as it passes through the unit tree, what measurement A sees is just the state VI, V sub I, which so it yields outcome I with certainty. And then if we change that V into U dagger, then the output state is the same. So the whole arrangement behaves like, if I feed in this state, I get outcome I with certainty, and then I get the same state out. So now let me just make some definitions. I just define the VI dash in this way, which means I can expand any state V in terms of these VI dash. And now I can just feed state V through this arrangement and see what happens. So V gets transformed to this state here. It yields outcome I with this probability because we know how measurement A behaves. We have the rules for that. And then the output state is VI dash. So basically, this is tells you Horn's rule. It allows you to calculate the outcome probabilities of this measurement A dash.
Sorry, maybe I missed a second. How do we know the rules for measurement A?
Because those are what we started off with. The whole derivation is from with respect to measurement A.
So there's two sort of hidden variables there corresponding to a given measurement outcome. It's an explicit property of the system going into the measurement rather than a property of the measurement output. Do you see what that means?
No. Can you try to
say
that again?
I don't see it. I mean, you have a measurement which subdivides outcomes and says, well, for each outcome, they actually contain two real properties that we don't have access to.
Right.
But there seems to be another step to say, and it's those properties which determine which measurement outcome, or those properties of the system, and they determine which measurement outcome you get. But they could, for example, be the state generated by that measurement outcome, but the measurement could act in an entirely random way. So it's produce either microstate P1 or microstate P1 prime, corresponding to outcome 1.
I mean, the fact that the final state in your formalism is only defined up to a phase, I think, takes into account the possibility that this extra degree of freedom that's been introduced could be randomized, because it ultimately corresponds to that phase. But
I'm just suggesting local randomization.
But I think if you say, well, what if they were randomized differently? And that wouldn't be captured by the one phase degree freedom you have here.
You see, the state after the measurement is performed, this state here has one, and then it's a whole bunch of zeros. So only two of the events probabilities actually matter. Right. So there really is only one random degree. There's only one degree of freedom that you don't know about. You see what I mean?
Okay.
So for example, you outcome.
That's fine. It's just a slightly more detailed model of measurement. I mean,
Okay. All right. So just summarize the steps in the derivation very quickly. So we have the idea of complementarity, which leads us to represent the state of a system like this, and then I've imposed the information metric. And then I introduced the idea of metric preservation, which kind of motivated going to the whole of the unit hypersphere. And then the requirement that the metric is preserved by the transformation told us that the transformations are orthogonal. And finally, global gauge invariance restricted the possible transformations to type 1 and type 2 orthogonal transformations, which correspond to unitary and anti-unitary transformations of the complex version of the state. And in further steps in the derivation, one can derive the tensor quadratic rule, the the temporal evolution operator, and also the correspondence rules of quantum theory that you need to actually apply the formalism in particular cases of interest. Things like the correspondence, like these commutation relations. So what have we learned? Well, first of all, one of the striking things for me is how important global gauge invariance is. It seems like a fairly incidental feature of the quantum formalism. It doesn't seem to be particularly important. But here, it actually gives us the linearity of the evolution of a complex state. And it actually shows us why complex states and transformations are relevant or mathematically useful way of describing the quantum formalism. And then the idea of the information metric and the requirement that transformations are metric preserving shows why the square roots of probability are important. That came up very quickly. And why in pure state you have phases enter through these sinusoidal functions. So why these sinusoidal functions are there traces all the way back to the information metric. And then finally, as you saw, the fact that the transformations of the Q, the real form of the quantum state, why these transformations are orthogonal is directly related to the fact that the metric must be preserved. So from the point of view of this derivation, all of these concepts are secondary or derived. They're not fundamental, at least from this perspective, which is interesting because quite a lot of work in reconstructions takes the conjunction of these two properties as a starting point. It actually places great emphasis on the fact that quantum theory, on the one hand, allows for non-locality, but on the other hand, doesn't allow that to be used for signaling. And so it's interesting that in this reconstruction, one never has to consider separated systems and the behavior of separated systems to derive the core part of the formalism. Very quickly, some of the questions which are open are this coarse graining procedure, what is the physical basis behind that? Why don't we see these individual events? What is this sort of conspiracy that doesn't allow us to resolve these individual events? The second question one would like to ask, well, there are several, but I'm just pulling out a few of them, is this idea of metric preservation. Is there any analog that we can see there in classical probability theory? Is there any reason that we might expect that on any other grounds, apart from in this particular situation? And the global gauge invariance, as I've already said, it seems to play a very big role. And the question is, why? Does it actually represent something physically important? I think it does, but what does it represent? And then finally, you could ask the question, that's a very general question that I think should be asked of any reconstruction of quantum theory. And that is, you've got these different ingredients that come into deriving quantum theory. But is there a single overarching idea from which you can see that each of these ideas is somewhat natural or even expected? And that's something that one would hope to obtain. It's really only that which would perhaps give an understanding that we would call a good understanding of quantum theory. If you have any thoughts on any of these questions, I'd be really interested in hearing them. Okay, thanks.
I'm not sure I understood why you chose the coarse graining to be on two rather than, say, three or four. Why two in particular?
Right. So I was trying to formalize the idea of complementarity, which is sort of in the very statement of it, saying that we're only able to access half of the degrees of freedom in the state of the system.
Why half?
Okay, so this is the idea of complementarity. So I'm just taking that as a given. So this is Bohr's idea. He's sort of abstracting from what he saw in the quantum formalism and raising that to a sort of a principle almost. So I'm simply taking that as a given.
Did he say it should be
Would it be fair to say that you did that because when you expand a wave function in an orthogonal basis, then each of the components has a magnitude and a phase, and so there were your two.
I mean, there are different. That's the formal expression. Another way of saying it is that in classical particle mechanics, let's say you need minimum of 2 degrees of freedom to specify the state of the system, position, and velocity. And basically, when you describe the same situation in the quantum formalism, you're only able to access one of those two properties. I mean, this was originally Bohr's path to the idea of complementarity. So, you know, you could take it in that way, that for some reason that we're not able to access both of these properties simultaneously, only one of them.
I'm not sure the duality that's inherent in Bohr's notion of complementarity is something that you want to make a motivation for your introduction. I can't remember who it was, but there was a sort of a criticism of that notion of complementarity. I think from a modern perspective, we realize it was a mistake to concentrate on two, for like position momentum. So one simple example is if you go to a spin and a half system, you have the spin in the x, y, and z directions, which are all mutually complementary.
Right.
So there isn't a pair.
Mm-hmm.
There's these three possible pairs. But even in the case of a single particle, there's a sense in which not only position momentum are complementary, but if I take any linear combination, say cos theta x plus sine theta p, that's complementary to x for any theta. So it seems to me maybe the motivation for introducing an extra degree of freedom should be something different from complementary. I guess I'm not sure that really captures this mathematical notion.
What do you think would be a better motivation?
I don't know. But it strikes me that ultimately what you get out of it is a phase associated with every outcome of your measurement. And in that sense, it reminds me a lot of So you mentioned Hamilton-Jacobi at one point, and I don't know exactly how that works, but if that phase ends up being e to the I s, where s is Hamilton's function, then this looks a lot like Nelson mechanics, that sort of program applied to discrete degrees of freedom. And so Nelson has a particular motivation for, he has a probability distribution over space, and he has a Hamilton function, and he says, what if we combine them by root of the probability distribution of e to the I, Hamilton's function, and that's just a formal step.
Right. I mean, yeah, so...
Is that right, that the phase that you end up introducing is e to the I times the Hamilton-Jacobi function in some sense, or is that not happening?
Well, here everything is in a finite dimensional, so I don't explicitly bring in the Hamilton-Jacobi function.
You said some words earlier that about it. So,
oh, I see. Yes. So what ends up happening is these chi I variables end up being, when you do the classical quantum correspondence, you end up with chi I equals S I over H bar, where S I is the discretized form of the action. So you've got the action over space time. Then you've got S 1, S 2, and so on through S n at different spatial locations. So that would be the correspondence.
So then ultimately you do have an e to the I, s I. You have a discrete Hamilton-Jacobi function, and your phases are just the Hamilton-Jacobi function. So I think it is analogous to Nelson's theory. So maybe you can find a motivation by doing the discrete analog of Nelson's theory.
Is your point of view then that the wave function is real, is the reality? Is that, I mean, you didn't say anything like that, but that seems to be the terms in which you talked about the extra phase information.
Right. I mean, so from this point of view, I'm using the framework of classical probability theory. And so certainly when I'm talking about these two end events, then they're treated on an equal footing in the sense that they, you really have to say they are realized in some way, physically. And so, so you do actually give a reality to them. They're at the same level of reality, really, as the outcomes.
Yes, but that's not the same as giving reality to the wavefront.
What do you mean by the other wavefront?
Well, if I understand Raphael's question, it's the old one in place, interpretations of probabilities. Are probabilities real things, or are they statements of either knowledge or ignorance? So you're saying that the hidden events are real, but the wave function is some measure of probability.
Well, it's not entirely. I mean,
because
of what's happening here is that there is this extension to the whole of the unit hypersphere. And so you're introducing binary degrees of freedom in addition to these two end probabilities. And the actual, so there is a proviso there. But leaving that aside, I mean, when you're using probability theory and you're talking about these events, and you're saying that these events happen, then you're giving them a reality straight away.
But it looks like the possible states of reality, the cardinality of that set is 2n.
Mm-hmm.
But the cardinality of a set of state vectors is a continuous infinity. So the states of reality, it looks like you have 2n possible states of reality.
Okay. So that's
what it looked like to me.
Right, these are the possible events, but that's still these open whether you take the state itself to be in some sense real or not. I don't think it bears that way.
I didn't understand entirely. The answer is that it's open. You're not taking a position. This doesn't. I mean, it looked to me that this was tending towards saying that the state vector is real.
I'm not sure what that means. I mean, the thing is that in this case, I'm just treating it to be a mathematical description that allows me to. I'm taking a quite operational point of view and saying, okay, I'm trying to build a mathematical object that suffices to enable me to predict outcome probabilities in various situations. So essentially, you stand back on the question of whether it's real or not.
Well, but in real, you could also do in real situations. You could do measurements that weren't these complete measurements. And then I think the phase relations between, if you went into a new basis corresponding to the new subspace you're measuring, I think it would, your state would have some expression in terms of those new pairs of variables. The phase relations would all be important, most of all but one of them.
That's right.
Would be important. And
yes.
So it's almost like giving it a reality, but maybe we shouldn't ripple over the word.
Yeah. Basically, those two end cues, they all get, they end up all, in the end in as being the real imaginary parts of a pure state.
Mm-hmm.
So all of those degrees of freedom part one are relevant predictively.
So let me ask you a different, less, sort of more practical in a sense. I mean, this is the question I almost always want to ask about any reconstruction like this. What you reconstruct is very much a non-relativistic form of quantum mechanics, let alone, I mean, it's not only not quantum gravity or something, but it's not even merely quantum field theory, or it doesn't have Lorentz invariants in any natural way, as far as I can see. So if you wanted to extend this to quantum field theory, or ultimately to quantum gravity, then we believe, at least many of us believe, that you'd have to sacrifice some of these features that you have produced, that you've reconstructed. So do you have any thoughts on what you would relax or what you might change in the input to be consistent with curved space, or to be consistent with Minkowski space type of?
So which of these assumptions do you think you'd need to relax?
That's my question.
No, you don't understand. Okay, so from my point of view, I've derived here a sort of finite dimensional quantum formalism, which suffices to do, so you can use that. I mean, obviously you need the continuous form, but you can use that to do field theory and such. So I don't see a conflict there. I mean, this makes no statements about space whatsoever. It's non-spatial.
Well, just to take one example, so Lucien is working on these But I mean, you assume very, very much your time sequence. Of
course.
So in context of quantum gravity, you might say that that won't have any fundamental meaning, even if you still know what you mean by measurements. That's one sort of example.
Another one
is that, to my knowledge, there exists no, in quantum field theory, there exists no coherent measurement scheme. Right? I mean, one knows that certain things that you naively could measure, certain self-adjoint operators, can't be measured under pain of causality violation. I mean, signaling causality. Right? So you know there are large numbers of observables, quote unquote, that you couldn't measure by the kind of measurement that you're talking about here, these idealized non-demolition measurements. So which ones can we? I mean, so you're already stuck there if you try to apply this to quantum fields. So which measurements would you? I mean, I don't have the answer. I'm asking, but it seems to me that there's need some generalization or some modification to go to quantum field theory and then beyond that. This is where you don't have a background causal structure like quantum gravity.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, you need to make the step from this to how it, you know, the continuous form of the quantum formalism. So here everything is finite dimensional. So you, now that's one step that one has to deal with. And that's in progress. That the interesting thing is it does throw up interesting problems. So it's not just a it's not as trivial as it might seem. So that's one thing that one would have to consider. When it comes to this, I think the issue of causal ordering of measurements, then you just, well, you need a more robust idea of when a system has really been prepared or not. So you need an operational procedure to tell you when you know that if you do a measurement at some point, that the system indeed has been prepared in its past.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need some kind of formal procedure. So I think that's more of an issue of defining an operational procedure, which is clear enough to apply in that circumstance, and then applying this formalism if that condition is met. I don't see it as requiring a... I don't see that situation as requiring...
What about the thing about not all measurements are implementable? It's not true that every... Mm-hmm.
What this is saying is that any measurement that can be implemented can be represented in terms of measurement A. But it doesn't assert that you can actually realize them. I mean, on physical grounds. So you know, it doesn't actually commit. But I agree, it would be interesting to make that extension.
I thought it was a really good idea to draw us down here to this room. I'm glad you did that. So, you know, more people here. In-house seminars would be great to do it down here rather than up in Boston.